Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Damn Radio. If you'd like to call in, please do. We can talk about whatever you like. Call 573-746-8020 or email live at damradio.com. This is Jack's Car Show. I'm broadcasting live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. This is Damn Radio. So this week I want to talk about Lamborghini. That's going to be the main focus of the show. I want to talk about the origins of the company and some weird stuff they've made and some weird choices they've made and how they kept being bought and sold and so on. But first, I want to just get into some miscellaneous stuff like I usually do. So the new Corvette ZR1, the online configurator is out now, and those are always fun to play with. And they won't tell you prices on the car, I assume because they want to make it seem like the dealer isn't just completely screwing you over when they charge you like 50 grand over sticker for the first 5 years this thing's out. But, I mean, naturally, the one that I spec'd out on that configurator is the best looking, and everybody else has poor taste. And I've always liked the Corvette configurator because it just, you know, at least compared to every other configurator, because it seems like you can usually pick whatever individual options you want, except for the mechanical stuff. And that's what I don't like about the Corvette configurator. You know, you can pick your colors and wheels and graphics and upholstery and any combination of that you want. It's great. But, like, the performance stuff is more complicated, and that's... That doesn't apply to the ZR1 as much. The ZR1, it pretty much comes as it is already out of the box, the craziest thing in the world. But, you know, it just seems like a thing that manufacturers do lately. They just group options together to extort you. Because, and I think we need to end that as a society. Because, like, say I want just a totally standard base C8 Corvette, you know, Stingray. But I want the more aggressive, you know, rear gearing. Because I want to do drag launches, say. But I don't want to spend that much money. Well, the problem is, you know, in order to get the more aggressive rear gearing, you have to get the Z51 Performance Pack, which also comes with different shocks and different exhausts and different brakes and a whole bunch of stuff. And so that one option that you want that maybe would cost like $1,500 by itself, well, it's not actually available unless you buy like $7,000 worth of other stuff you don't care about. That's just the way options work lately. And every automaker's worse than that, usually. I mean, usually there's like three things you can click on a car configurator. The worst offender to me that annoys me the most is the BMW GS configurator. And I know that's not a car, but it's just infuriating to me. You know, it's because they spread out all the options you want just to as many different packages as possible. And so, say you want electronic suspension, which to me, you know, you got to have that. I've never seen one without that. I presume they don't even let you buy one that way, you know. But you want the electronic suspension, and that on its own would cost $1,200, let's say. But in order to get that, you got to get the dynamic pack, which is like $3,000. And so, you know, say you also want chrome exhaust headers because you think they look cool and you want your bike to be stylish. Well, inexplicably, chrome exhaust headers are included in the touring package. And that comes with, like, hand protector extensions and central locking. And so chrome headers that, you know, on their own should be, like, a $250, if not just no-cost option. But in order to get it, you have to buy, like, another $2,000 or $3,000 worth of stuff you don't need. And so you look at the MSRP of the 1300 GS, and it starts at, like, 19-something. You know, and you think, oh, that's a good deal. You know, it's competitive. You know, it's only a little bit more than an Africa Twin, and it's kind of there with the Harley Pan America. But, you know, the problem is when you get those like two or three options you actually want, when all's said and done, you got like a $30,000 bike. It's obnoxious. And I'm aware there's not a single recorded instance in history of anybody ever actually custom ordering a motorcycle. But still, what's the point of a configurator when all I can do is just click two things and decide what color I want my $30,000 bike to be? Because, again, it's going to be 30 no matter what you want. I'm not even sure they let you buy a base model of those things, to tell you the truth. I bet if they did let you order it, you know, they'd make you put down like a $15,000 deposit just in case you don't take delivery. They want no part of those things. They want you to option those things up. I've seen prototypes that didn't have electronic suspension. I remember the 1250. I saw a prototype, or it wasn't even a prototype. It was a press photo. So presumably they did make one of them that didn't have keyless go. But I've never actually seen one without it. I assume they just automatically check all those boxes whenever dealers order them, and it's probably really difficult to get one the other way. And another thing, configurators. there's plenty of vehicles that have configurators that don't really need configurators. Like, you know, there's a Jeep Compass configurator. Most people who are buying that probably don't even have access to the internet, because if they did, they'd know that they should buy a better car. But can you imagine your life going so wrong that you find yourself sitting on the computer and specking out a Jeep Compass? So, anyway, back to motorcycles for a little bit, just a second, I promise. A quick second on the Honda Goldwing. Again, I've talked about it the last 2 weeks. I'll shut up about it after this. But I mentioned last week they finally gave it wireless CarPlay and Android Auto. But what I didn't mention was that they took away the factory navigation. They just expect you to use your phone, which, you know, now you can just use the Android Auto and CarPlay. But kind of an unpopular opinion, I actually like the factory navigation. I've used factory Goldwing navigation, and I was glad to have it. Because I was out in the middle of nowhere. My phone didn't have any service, including GPS. I was an hour away from any kind of civilization. It was getting dark, and so I really think that factory navigation in any vehicle still has a place if you plan on actually doing any traveling. I think it's useful to have. On a touring bike, especially. You're paying like $30,000 for the thing. But, and then another thing about motorcycles. Royal Enfield recently announced their Shotgun 650 Icon Edition. The Icon Edition. And it was, as soon as I saw it, I just immediately loved it. Royal Enfield, I don't ever know how to feel about them. But that one specifically, it was just so cool. Because it's like an old-school cafe racer, cruiser kind of looking bike, and it's the color scheme is red, white, teal, and it's got like a black frame and gold wheels. It looks awesome. If they sold that colorway normally, they'd never be able to stop selling them. But the problem is they're making 100 of them, and only 25 of them are actually coming to the United States. And those ones got sold out within a few seconds. And I probably wouldn't have bought one, although objectively, I probably should have. Because I bet people are going to be scalping those. There's probably a few grand to be made there, or at least until everybody forgets about it and loses interest. But I never know what to think about Royal Enfield. Because, you know, ostensibly, they're one of the world's oldest motorcycle manufacturers. It's just that, you know, it was founded in England like a century ago. And you know, then they're kind of owned. They got bought out, and now they're owned and manufactured by Indians. Like the country, India, not Indian motorcycles. So, I mean, they're like Jaguar Land Rover in that way. You know, in theory, the Indians building it should be a positive, because I can't imagine there being anything worse than British build quality. And, you know, I don't have a problem with Indian bikes. Genuinely, I have a friend who used to have a Husqvarna 401, which is, it's like a cafe racer looking version of the KTM 390 Duke. And both of those bikes are built in India. And that thing was great. I love that thing. It was cool. And it seemed to be pretty reliable, and it was pretty well built. And, you know, I don't see any reason with the whole Indian-built motorcycle thing. It's those guys know how to build bikes. I mean, that's their main mode of transport in that country. My main gripe with Royal Enfield is that they really lean heavily on the whole, you know, old-school thing, and not just the aesthetic, you know, which can be good, you know, but it just seems like they keep using old technology, and the excuse is, it's like, oh, it's old-fashioned, you know? This is the way our forefathers did it. And I you know, the suspensions are crap, and they all weigh a ton. I mean, that's the problem with Royal Enfield. Everything weighs a lot. You know, the one I always think of is the Meteor 350, and that's like a beginner bike. I mean, that one really competes with, you know, the Rebel 300 Honda, except, you know, the Rebel makes like 25 horsepower. It weighs about 370 pounds. The Royal Enfield Meteor makes about 20 horsepower and weighs about 420 pounds. So this Royal Enfield, it's 5 horsepower down and 50 pounds heavier than a Rebel 300, which isn't exactly what you'd call a sport bike. Like, and you know, you give that a pass because, okay, it's the 350, it's the little one, right? It's the beginner bike. But the fastest thing they make is the Interceptor. And that's, you know, less than 50 horsepower, and it weighs about 470 pounds. You compare that to the Rebel 500, which, again, I wouldn't really call that a performance bike, and it makes the same power, but it weighs 50 pounds less. Although the Honda costs a little more, but come on. But people buy Royal Enfields like crazy. I mean, and they sell well. And to be fair, I kind of get it. Royal Enfields look cool, and they seem to be decently reliable, and they're cheap. You know, for as cool looking as they are, they're really cheap. And so from that angle, I get it. And that Icon Edition, I just love. It was badass. But on the other hand, it'd be like $7,500 for a bike with less than 50 horsepower. It doesn't really ride all that well. You know, if I was going to do that, what I'd really want is, So for the Honda Shadow, right? You got the Shadow, and that's like the big cruiser thing. But for a couple of years in the late 2000s, early 2010s, they made the Shadow RS, and that was like the sporty one. It looked kind of like a Harley Sportster. It had mid controls. It was cool. And so for the 2011 model year, they sold like a red, white, and blue version, and those are awesome. And I look for those occasionally. They're like $4,000. I really wouldn't mind having one. Like every July, I start doing a search, because, you know, and then I start sending my buddy links to Yamaha SCR 950s, because those are something he wants, and they're similar. Although that's like a scrambler, but they look the same. And I'm like, hey, dude, you should get this. I'll get this, and we should go to Sturgis, and that'll be great. But anyway, I'm going to move on to the main focus of the show, which is Lamborghini. I'll talk about how it was formed and some weird decisions they made. And, you know, for as cool as they were, even in the early days, the company was like always being purchased and heading towards bankruptcy or actually going bankrupt. That's all they knew how to do up until, well, I was going to say recently. It's not that recently. They got bought out in 98. It's like 30 years ago. So, I mean, it's not that recent, but in any case, the story starts with Ferruccio Lamborghini. So, Ferruccio had a few business ventures prior to becoming a car maker. Most people probably know some version of the story where, you know, Lamborghini came to Enzo Ferrari with a problem, and then, you know, Enzo pissed off Lamborghini in some way, and out of spite, Lamborghini vows to make a better car. And if I had a nickel for every time that exact thing happened with Enzo Ferrari, I would have two nickels. But Ferruccio was born in 1916 in Italy, and from a very young age, he was obsessed with farm equipment. He didn't care about farming. Like, he didn't want to be on a farm. He cared about the tractors and things that farmers used. And so when World War II started happening, he was drafted into the Italian Air Force, where he became a mechanic. But in 1943, Italy switched sides, meaning, you know, Germany basically just took a whole load of Italians as prisoners of war and then sent them to work camps because, you know, now they're the enemy. But Ferruccio managed to escape capture. Quietly, he kind of went back to work, and he offered to help the Germans with some miscellaneous stuff here and there. Not like a Holocaust, but just like menial stuff around the factory, sweeping and whatever. Eventually, he managed to, you know, get on good enough terms with the Germans that they let him open his own mechanic shop. And so that was fine. But when the war ended, the British occupied parts of Italy, and so Ferruccio was arrested for just kind of playing pretty nicely with the Germans. They didn't like that. And so he was held for about a year, and he was released. And so he started taking old military surplus equipment and parts and essentially made tractors out of them using a supply of Morris straight six diesel engines. And he figured out how to take those engines and get them to run on. They were diesel engines. He figured out how to get them to run on diesel, you know, rather than gasoline, because in post-war Italy, gasoline was just ridiculously expensive. And I'm not going to try and explain exactly how he managed to do it. Basically, he figured out how to develop a fuel atomizer that made it so you could start the engine on gasoline, but once it was running, it just ran on diesel. And so his tractors became somewhat popular, especially when the Italian government started issuing tax incentives to Italian farmers as long as they bought an Italian-made tractor. And so, you know, Ferruccio did that. He was making some decent money. So he kind of took some of that, and he wanted to be a racing driver. And the tractor thing gave him money to do it. But, I mean, that was short-lived. His whole attitude toward racing changed when he crashed a Fiat 500, like an original Fiat 500, the Topolino, into the side of a building when he was participating in the Mille Miglia in 1948. And I remember something... I remember reading something that the famous Ferrari test driver, Valentino Balboni, had said, and it was something to the effect of, you know, Ferruccio liked to drive fast and aggressively, but he wasn't actually all that good at it. But it didn't matter, because Ferruccio's tractor business was kind of starting to take off, and he came out with a bunch of new models, and he was making a ton of money, so he decided to treat himself to some nice sports cars. He had a 300 SL Gullwing and an E-Type Jag and a couple of Ferraris. And, you know, he had those Ferraris, the 250s, and so he was driving one around one day, and the clutch went out. And he had had some trouble with Ferrari reliability in the past, because apparently on that car, that was like his third or fourth clutch. So he was really getting annoyed that he felt like he had to constantly have the car shipped back to Maranello to perform some repair that he felt wasn't really needed, or shouldn't be needed anyway. And so Ferruccio got sick of it. He decided he would try and fix the car himself, and he was disassembling everything. He realized the clutch in the Ferrari was the same part number as the clutch on a lot of Lamborghini's light-duty tractors, except when he had Ferrari replaced, it cost him like 100 times what it cost Ferruccio to just buy the part. And so, you know, Ferruccio wasn't happy about that, and he got to work on replacing the clutch and making a few other modifications until apparently the car is better than stock, or at least more reliable than stock. And so Ferruccio contacts Enzo, and he tells him basically, you know, this is it's all translated. I've heard this 1,000 different ways, you know, but he said, you know, I made a few little changes and the car's 1,000 times better. You guys should just do what I did. And so the pedophile's calling in, apparently. Let's just go ahead and turn that down. There we go. I don't know if that guy's like actually retarded or if it's just like a character he plays, but anyway. So, Ferruccio, you know, gets a hold of Enzo, and Enzo's not one to take advice. You know, he's famous for being really proud, which is to say he's a douche. I mean, he's just a douchebag. And so Enzo wasn't have it, and he wasn't going to take car building advice from a tractor mechanic. And nobody knows exactly what was said, but I've heard it 1,000 different ways over the years, but Enzo said some variation of, you build tractors, I build race cars, don't tell me how to build race cars. And so Ferruccio's all like, well, evidently you don't know how to build race cars, I'll show you how to build race cars. And so Lamborghini went off and he started his own car company, pretty much out of spite. And he could do that because really Ferruccio Lamborghini was just rich. He had a really successful tractor business, and so this was just kind of a spinoff. And, you know, he wouldn't do it if it wasn't worth his while financially, but if the car brand failed, then so be it. You know, it was fine. He'd be fine. But the thing about Lamborghini is that Ferruccio didn't really want to build sports cars, which is fine because arguably Ferrari didn't even make sports cars at the time. When you think about it, every Ferrari up until the original Dino was some variation of big, long front-engine V12-powered GT car that had a live rear axle and acres of leather on the inside and, you know, handmade build quality. You know, every Ferrari was what we would think of as a grand tourer, not some crazy mid-engine sports car like we think of them making now. And so, you know, Ferruccio Lamborghini wanted to sell a better, more advanced version of that. He wanted his cars to be really fast, obviously, but he wanted them to be comfortable and reliable and smooth and technologically advanced. And so Ferruccio felt that Ferraris were really good sporty cars, but they were really crappy road cars. You know, the interiors, again, they're covered in leather, but everything was loud and everything just felt like crap. And obviously he thought they were too unreliable and finicky and he had a point, because to be fair, at the time, Ferraris were kind of crappy. They were very handmade feeling, which is to say that usually when you look at a 60s Ferrari, for example, one side's door is slightly longer than the other by half an inch or so. That's not uncommon at all. That's just the way it was. Nothing on a Ferrari back then was perfect. And the mechanicals were usually just developed using whatever spare parts they had lying around. You know, again, they had used just a random off-the-shelf clutch that was used in tractors. So, you know, Ferruccio was right to point out the poor quality control. And so he felt that car building should be a precise, clean operation. And so Ferrari's factory back then, it was just like a dark, dank warehouse where some guys kind of haphazardly slung cars together to sell them for astronomical prices to idiots in order to fund their racing operation. And that was really the problem with Ferrari. Enzo Ferrari he famously didn't care for his customers. I don't mean like he didn't treat them well. I mean, he didn't like them. You know, he only made road cars to have enough money to build race cars. He didn't care about the road cars at all. But Lamborghini, on the other hand, wanted nothing to do with building race cars. He wanted to offer great customer service, and he wanted to build great road cars. And so his factory was always a nice, tidy, spotless work area filled with all the latest machinery. And the entire time Ferruccio ran things, he just wanted the highest quality customer service. That was what he was after. I remember seeing a speech that Ferruccio gave, and it was in Italian, obviously, but I'm sort of paraphrasing. But he said, like, if a customer in England or Spain or something has a problem with their car, we fly one of our mechanics out there, the mechanic fixes it, he apologizes to the customer for inconvenience, then comes back, flies back. And whoever he was talking to responds with, you know, that must be really expensive for the customer. And then Ferruccio replies, no, it doesn't cost the customer anything. It costs us a lot, but it's basically an advertising expense because customer gets this great service and he tells all his rich friends about it. And, you know, see, you can see why the company went bankrupt so much, but that's skipping ahead. But I mean, you understand where Ferruccio's head was. He was sick of Ferrari's horrible customer service. And so the cars Ferruccio wanted to build, think like in Ferruccio's mind, the Ferrari is like a C6 Corvette, and what he wants to build is a Bentley Continental. So Ferruccio starts work on his new cars, and another thing to consider here is that when Automobili Lamborghini was founded in 1963, Ferruccio was 47 years old, but most of his design team was in their 20s. Like, he'd hired a few guys right out of college. And so, you know, Ferruccio wanted a nice, comfortable GT car, but most of his design team wanted to make crazy race cars. And so he needed an engine for his new car. So he hired one of Ferrari's old engine builders, a guy named Giotto Bizzarini, to design him an engine. And Bizzarini was to be paid a flat $4.5 million Italian Fina, which I don't know. I tried to figure out what that works out to today, but I mean, this is Italy in the 60s. It's probably backed by some sort of cheese. But the big thing is he was also to be paid a bonus for each additional horsepower that the engine made over the closest Ferrari engine. You know, and so what Bizzarini ended up with was a 3.5 liter V12 that made 368 horsepower at 9,800 RPM. It redlined at 11,000 RPM, which was great for a race engine, but Ferruccio didn't like it. Again, he didn't want a race car engine. He wanted a smooth GT car engine. So he fired Bizzarini and stiffed him on the money. And Bizzarini eventually, he sued Lamborghini and he got paid. And of course he did, because it was that basic engine design that Lamborghini used in all their flagship V12 supercars up until the Murcielago. And that ended production in 2010. And so they got like 50 years out of that design. Of course, you know, Bizzarini needed to get paid. But, you know, again, at first it was a racing engine. And so Ferruccio had his engineers work on it, make it build peak power lower in the rev range, essentially just detune the thing, you know, make it work for a GT car. And so, as a result of all that stuff going on with their V12, Lamborghini unveiled the 350 GTV concept at the Turin Motor Show, and it didn't even have an engine. You know, because again, they were doing all that, having all those problems with that engine. They slapped the car together so quickly, they didn't even know how to get the engine to fit. And so, in order to remedy that, apparently Ferruccio simply had his engineers put a bunch of bricks in the engine bay until the suspension sat at the correct height, you know. And then they just bolted the hood shut, and they just put the engine off to the side. But none of that stopped everybody from not noticing. Nobody was interested. Nobody cared. You know, and so they went ahead and they put it into production. They changed a few things. They made it look even better. And they came out with the 350 GT in 1963. And the car was a flop, which is weird because it's incredibly good looking, and it was a great car. And, you know, functionally, the car did everything Lamborghini wanted it to. It drove great. It was really well made, but it didn't sell all that great, you know. And then for 1966, they increased the displacement to 3.9 liters, and they lengthened the wheelbase and made the roofline taller. They added back seats, and they called it the 400 GT. And it sold about as well as the 350 GT had, which is to say, not well. But the car that really got Lamborghini going was the Miura. You know, that's really where Lamborghini starts as you know them. And I'd heard that Lamborghini's engineers became obsessed with the Ford GT40. I don't know if that's true. Because, you know, when the idea of the Miura was conceived, the GT40 existed, but it hadn't won Le Mans yet. And in fact, this is off topic, but I always kind of think the Ford versus Ferrari story is funny, because it's like, who are we supposed to cheer for in that story? Like, we're supposed to cheer for Ford, as if they're like an underdog. Like hooray, the massive multi-billion dollar corporation with an infinite budget beat the little Italian race car company that employs like 500 people. But, you know, in any case, Lamborghini's engineers wanted to build a car like that, and, you know, they wanted to build a race car. But Ferruccio didn't want that to be the sort of car his company made. So the Miura kind of started as an unofficial project. It was 7 Lamborghini engineers, and they worked after hours just for fun to kind of put it together. But, you know, eventually Ferruccio himself took notice, and he figured it'd be a great showpiece. They would just take it as a working project, you know, to bring people over to the Lamborghini booth at car shows. And he didn't understand how great of an idea that was, because when they took that to the 1965 Turin Motor Show, it was a huge success. They got 10 orders from it. And you got to understand, this car was not a car. It was a rolling chassis with an engine. Nobody had any idea what this car would look like, but it got 10 orders. So that was a big deal. I'll talk about the Miura and what comes next after the break. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. We'll be right back.
Johnson Lloyd. I have married broken spoke, charging smoke wheels, spit and swallowed opioids.
So we're back. This is Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. So, before the break, the Lamborghini Miura, it wasn't even a car yet. It was just a chassis with an engine. And they take it to the motor show and they get 10 orders. And the main reason that it attracted so much attention was nobody was doing mid-engine sports cars when this thing came out. It just wasn't a thing. Because think about the best performance cars of the late 60s. You had Ferrari Daytona, the E-Type Jag. You make a list. I mean, it's just a list of front-engine GT cars, unless you count Porsche 911, which is rear-engine because Porsche is just weird. But, you know, the mid-engine road-going supercar as a concept began with the Miura. It was revolutionary. But, you know, it was revolutionary. So what that meant is nobody knew how to make it work. You know, because the problem they had was the engine, as far as displacement, was relatively small, 3.9 liters. But the actual engine, you know, the block and everything, it took up more space than a big block Chevrolet 427. And so that presented some problems with fitting it in this little tiny car. And the car was supposed to be really compact and have a short wheelbase. And so, they couldn't just slap this thing in. You know, it wasn't going to work. And you know, you think, okay, well, you do it longitudinally. Well, no, that doesn't work. They considered it. you know, you have the engine front to back like you would up front in any normal car. But they had thought about it early on. They had a concept with three seats so that, you know, the center seat would sit farther forward than the others, meaning that the engine had some extra space, but they decided that wasn't going to work. But they noticed how much of a packaging miracle the Austin Mini was and how they had mounted the engine transversely up front. It was front engine, front wheel drive, and so the engineers just copied that idea. And so for the Miura, the engine, the transmission, differential, it's all one unit. You look up a picture of the Miura's engine block, it's wild. You know, but it meant the engine would fit transversely. You know, but anyway, you know, they get those 10 orders at that auto show, and so Ferruccio sees that, and, you know, it's 10 orders for something that doesn't even exist as a car yet, and so he realized maybe he was wrong. Maybe this was what people wanted, and so he told his engineering team, just go ahead and make it. And so Lamborghini got into contact with the styling house Bertone, who had just hired a new chief designer, and the chief designer was a 27-year-old, just like everybody else on the engineering team at Lamborghini. His name was Marcello Gandini, and Gandini got to work, and within 2 months, Lamborghini had a working prototype. Like, rolling chassis without anything to a working, driving car with a body in 2 months. It was quick. And the design itself is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, ever since I was in, like, sixth grade, I thought the Miura was just the best-looking car in the world. It's just absolutely insane. And Gandini designed this thing after he'd been working for Bertone for, like, a couple weeks. I mean, again, the car went from not having a body to being a working prototype of the best-looking car in the world in 2 months. Gandini's a miracle worker. And something to point out with the design, the Miura's windows are frameless except for the back pillar. So when you open the doors, they're supposed to look like a bull's horns. And it's the same reason that the Lamborghini logo is a bull. Ferruccio Lamborghini's birthday is April 28th. You know, he's a Taurus, which is a bull. He liked bulls, apparently, and bullfighting. And one of Ferruccio's best friends was a guy named Don Eduardo Miura Fernandez, and he was a famous bullfighter in Italy, and so he named the car after him. And that's also why a lot of other Lamborghinis are named after bull-related things. You know, the Islero, the Yalpa, the Uraco, they're all named after bulls. The Jarama is named after a famous breeding ground for bulls. The Espada translates to sword, which, like, the sword that a bullfighter would use to kill a bull. Ferruccio Lamborghini was into bulls, but anyway, back to the Miura. Because really they came up with all these crazy ideas for this radical new sports car. And again, rolling chassis to working car in 2 months, like, they developed it super quickly. And they just put it on sale, it seemed like, before they actually did any testing. So as a result, the Miura had some issues. Like, like, major issues. Because dynamically, everyone's main complaint was the handling. Not that it was in itself bad, it handled reasonably well. But the problem was the shape of the car meant the front end liked to lift off the ground at high speed. And that problem was made worse by the fact that that's also where the fuel tank was, meaning as you ran low on gas, the front end would weigh even less. And so under certain conditions, it speeds up above 100, you pretty much just lose steering, and, you know, because the front wheels are barely touching the ground at that point. So you wouldn't be able to steer, and you'd run off the road, and you'd crash, and you'd die. And also, the engine and transmission and diff are all one unit, which is great. They all share the same oil, which is 16 quarts, in case you were wondering. But the early cars were designed in such a way that it all shared a single sump, and so the oil could just kind of slosh to one side or the other, meaning if you were going along a long sweeping corner at high speeds, the engine could just completely lock up, and you'd spin off the road, and you'd die. And also, the cars like to catch fire. One known issue is that, you know, again, the fuel tank's up front, as was the battery, so if something starts leaking, that's obviously not great, but the big problem is the carburetors, because the carbs themselves had some issues, like, you know, a float fails or whatever, but in certain cases, they would just eject fuel out of the carburetor. And guess what? The engine was designed in such a way that the carbs were mounted directly over the spark plugs, meaning occasionally you'd be driving along and the carbs would just dump fuel all over the ignition and the car would burst into flames and you'd burn and you'd die. And so the Miura had some issues, but nobody cared because there was nothing else like it. There were no other mid-engine race cars for the road anywhere. And its reputation was helped by the fact that it was the fastest car in the world when it came out. Did 0 to 60 in 5.5 seconds. It would hit a top speed of 170. In 1967, that's a big deal. Fastest car in the world. And again, keep in mind, the car was developed by a bunch of 20-somethings, originally without the permission of their boss, and it was in production within 2 years. And it was the craziest, fastest, probably best-looking car in the world. And that's all pretty remarkable. And so, you know, it sold reasonably well, given what it was. which, I mean, as well as it could sell, given that it costs three times as much as a Porsche 911. But, you know, in the end, between 66 and 73, Lamborghini sold 741 Miuras. But, you know, despite somewhat decent sales, I mean, Lamborghini wasn't making any money. It wasn't worth it to Lamborghini, so, you know, it wasn't worth it to Ferruccio. So he kind of just checked out. He appointed one of his engineers, a guy named Paolo Stensani, to be the general manager and technical director. And because Lamborghini realized if they just built what he wanted them to, they wouldn't sell anything. You know, he figured he should just let his men do their thing. You know, he still owned Lamborghini, but he mostly gave up control. Although, inexplicably, around the time he left, Lamborghini started making a whole load of cars that would have been exactly what Ferruccio wanted. Because that same year, 1968, Lamborghini released the Espada, which was a front-engine four-seat GT car that had the V12 engine from a Miura. That same year, they also released the Islero, which was a front-engine four-seat GT car that had the V12 from a Miura. 2 years after that, Lamborghini released the Jarama, which was a front-engine four-seat GT car that had the V12 from a Miura. So automobile Lamborghini definitely had a type. And those cars sold reasonably well, too, but again, they weren't making money. And so in 72, Ferruccio sold off 51% of his stake in the company to one of his friends, a Swiss guy named George Henry, you know, George Henry Rossetti. And then 2 years later, he sold his remaining 49% stake to one of Rossetti's friends, a guy named Rene Lamar. And so, in other words, Lamborghini was out. So the company was under completely new management and completely new ownership. And Ferruccio, at this point, had no ties to Lamborghini. It wasn't his company. He simply retired and moved away. He lived a comfortable life until he died a few years later, probably 20 or 30 years. But anyway, so after Rossetti takes over, he starts pushing Lamborghini to get their new supercar, which would have been the Countach, into production. And Stensani had been working on it since 1970 because he knew that the Miura had been very good for them as a brand. I mean, from an image standpoint, if nothing else. And so they needed another mid-engine supercar. And by the time the company was under new ownership, the design of the Countach was already pretty well underway. And they took what they learned from the Miura and they started on what became the Countach. Because by that point, Lamborghini and Ferrari had both learned that a transversely mounted mid-engine was kind of dumb for what they were trying to do. And obviously the Miura had always had weight distribution issues, as evidenced by the fact that, again, the front end just likes to come up at high speed. And so they wanted the V12 to be mounted longitudinally, front to back, meaning that rather than having the engine just transversely mounted sitting on top of its transmission and differential that concentrates like all the way to the engine in one spot, they figured it'd make more sense to have the engine lengthways and put the transmission in front of the engine between the seats. And if you look at a Countach, it's a sight to behold. Look at the picture of the Countach next to its drivetrain. It's wild how big the engine and transmission is compared to the car, how tightly packed it is. It's crazy. And so they got Marcello Gandini to design the Countach since he'd done a really great job with the Miura, obviously. And people say that the name of the car, it came from an amazed reaction. There's no direct translation for the word Countach into English, but it basically just means wow. The story that everybody always tells is that in a meeting, Marcello Gandini unveiled the design for the car, and upon seeing it, somebody in the room yelled out Countach as kind of an expression of amazement, and they liked the name, and so it stuck. But Gandini himself says it's not true. He says, what happened was Lamborghini had hired a guy to essentially get stuff ready for an auto show. You know, set everything up, put the signs together, build all the big pedestals, that kind of thing. And the guy had a habit of saying Countach, which, again, it's some old Italian word from some obscure dialect that it literally translates to illness. But, you know, it's used to express surprise or amazement or shock. So it's not far off from Americans calling things sick. But, you know, they hired this guy, and this guy's walking around occasionally saying that word, and Gandini and some other guys are joking around with him, and somebody brought up the idea that they named the car Countach. It turned out everybody liked the sound of it, so they called it the Countach. And that's from the designer of the car himself. I'm inclined to believe that. It's way less interesting than the story we're supposed to be told, but anyway, you know, Countach was everybody's reaction when they unveiled it to the world. I mean, everybody lost their minds, because it was the craziest car anybody'd ever seen. I mean, that was an early Countach. That was before they added, you know, the crazy fender flares and wings. And to be clear, I think those early cars, the ones that everybody calls Periscopos, are the best looking, where it's a narrow body, no fender flares, and like narrow tires. I think that was the best looking. I think when they added the fender flares and the big spoiler, and certainly when they added those side strikes, I really didn't like it that much. And it seems like the market agrees with me that Periscopos go for a ton of money compared to the regular ones, which already go for a ton of money. But, you know, the early cars just look like a wedge. You know, it was crazy. And it became an icon immediately. I mean, millions of people had posters of it on their bedroom walls. It was a big deal for car design, and pretty much it set the trend for every supercar ever since. And that's really the great irony. Because remember, Freesia Lamborghini started this whole thing by trying not to sell crazy sports cars. But the fact is that the supercar as we know it, every supercar that's come since, has followed the formula that the Miura had laid out. And Ferrari, who actually was trying to sell sports cars and was the big name in the game, just copied Lamborghini. And here's what I mean. So within a few years of the Miura, Ferrari came out with their own mid-engine sports cars, the 206 and the 246, the Dinos. And those weren't really competitive with the Miura. They were the small, tossable little sports cars. They weren't just crazy world-beating supercars like the Miura. But then Ford tried to compete directly with Lamborghini by coming out with the 365 Boxer. And it didn't really work because people were still obsessed with the Lamborghini. And the Boxer was made irrelevant almost immediately because the following year, Lamborghini came out with the Countach. So Ferrari, you know, just couldn't keep up with Lamborghini supercars. But to be fair, Ferrari had better success with the smaller mid-engine sports car segment, like 206, 246. And Lamborghini tried to get into that too with the Uraco. It was supposed to be the entry-level Lamborghini little mid-engine V8 sports car. But then in 75, Ferrari hit back with the 308 GTB and the GTS, which that was the first of the two-seat mid-engine V8 Ferrari line that continued up until very recently. You know, and so they came out with that, and then Lamborghini tried to come back with the Silhouette and then later the Yalpa, although those never really sold all that well. So Ferrari was beating Lamborghini in the small sports car game, but that's, you know, that's really where most sales come from, but it's not really where the brand identity is made, you know? People love the 308, but they're blown away by the Countach. You know, because from an image standpoint, making the craziest, wildest, big supercar is where you want to be. And Lamborghini made the Countach for a while, and eventually Ferrari came out the Testarossa to try and be cooler than the Countach, you know? But, and you'd think, you know, the Testarossa came out like a decade after the Countach. You think it'd be a massive leap forward, but Lamborghini did a pretty good job of keeping the Countach fresh, and so performance-wise, the cars are pretty even, except again, you know, the Countach looks like the Countach, and the Testarossa doesn't. So, in other words, in the supercar world, the supercar that everybody bought was the Ferrari with 308, but the supercar everybody wanted was the Countach, and that probably explains why Lamborghini had trouble keeping the lights on, which is kind of weird, because it was such an iconic car, but Countaches were worthless for quite a long time. If I could go back in time, I would go back, I don't know, 20 or 30 years and just fill a warehouse full of Countaches. Because even in the 2000s, you could pick a Countach up for like 60 or 70 grand because nobody wanted to deal with owning one. It was too annoying. It was way too much maintenance. Only in the last 15 years or so have the values really picked up. I mean, remember, they were cheap enough that when they were filming The Wolf of Wall Street, the studio agreed to destroy a real Countach rather than convincing enough people, you know, rather than just make a convincing enough fake one. And that movie came out in 2013. Like, at the time, yeah, it probably would have been cheaper to build a replica, but it wasn't that big a deal, and Scorsese wanted it to look as real as possible because he knew people like me would watch the movie and then look at the car and point out all the ways it looked fake. He didn't want to take away from the realism of the movie. Although, if you want to talk realism, in real life, Jordan Belfort crashed a Mercedes like that. So the Countach wasn't the realistic choice if you want to split hairs, but, you know, they took a real Countach and they crashed into a bunch of parked cars and mailboxes and things in a scene that maybe took up 20 seconds and was shot mostly in the dark and from a distance. But I mean, it wasn't the end of the world. At the time, the car was probably low six figures. I bet the price started with a one, but now that's a five to $700,000 car, I think. And that's a 25th anniversary. That's the one that nobody wants. But that's how quickly people started caring about the Countach again. It's only very recent. Although, to be fair to Scorsese, the wrecked one went up for auction about a year ago and it failed to sell, although the high bid was $1.35 million, so, I mean, it's worth at least that. So, arguably, it wasn't a terrible way to spend money, but anyway, back to the mid-70s, the problem that the Lamborghini had was, even though everybody loved the Countach, they were having trouble actually getting them built. In the late 60s, early 70s weren't really a great time to be in the exotic sports car business, you know, as evidenced by the fact that Ferrari could no longer make it on their own because they got bought out by Fiat. You know, you watch Ford versus Ferrari, that movie, it's a it's kind of a thing that happens in the plot where it extra pisses off Ford because they claim that Ferrari was trying to just play him so that they get a better offer from Fiat. Well, no, because Fiat didn't buy Ferrari in the early 60s. It was, I forget what the year was, late 60s, early 70s when that actually happened. And also Maserati needed to be bailed out. They got bought out by Citroen. And so, you know, Lamborghini's barely hanging on in the first place. They're the new kid in town. And so, you know, things aren't really going super great. And then in 1973, there's an oil crisis. So building crazy expensive supercars with massive thirsty engines wasn't really the business you wanted to be in. Although, you know, to be fair, the new Countach was selling reasonably well. They just wasn't making enough money to pay their parts suppliers. And so they needed another source of income. And so they had two sources open to them in the late 70s. They could design a utility vehicle for militaries around the world, which was something they had absolutely no experience in, or they could design a new mid-engine supercar for BMW that they absolutely had experience in. And so which do you think they focused all their time and attention and money to? I'll talk about that after the break. I'll be right back. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.
Say there's a price you pay for going out too far. You can buy a one-way ticket out there all alone, and you can sit and wonder why it's so hard to get back home. Nothing is important. The longer you're in one place, the harder it is to leave. You can have a thousand cards to pull out of your sleeve, but in the end, the loser is the one who does deceive. There's always a reality in what you so hard to see which one is the true one. I used to treat my I was more than a millionaire.
You know, at its core, I don't hate country music. What I don't like is that, like, barbecue-flavored post-grunge pop rock that's just foisted into our collective eardrums every time we, you know, go into a grocery store. That's what I don't like. I don't mind the country sound, but anyway. So, before the break, I talked about how Lamborghini was in desperate need of money, and they had two potential income streams open up. So, I guess I'll start with the BMW M1. So, the M1 was BMW's first entrance into the whole performance car thing. Like, ground-up performance car, you know. Because BMW corporate bosses saw all the attention and business that Porsche was getting from competing in racing, and so they wanted to build an actual proper race car from the ground up. And so, yeah, I mean, BMW had the CSL, and it was a great race car, but it was ultimately just a modified road car. And, you know, Porsche came out the 935, and so that just overnight made the CSL irrelevant. And so this time, BMW figured they would build a race car, and then they would modify that for the road to meet homologation rules. But they had no experience with the whole mid-engine race car thing, and they had, you know, they just needed it done right. And so they had Giugiaro design it, and they signed a contract with Lamborghini. You know, to be clear, Lamborghini also had no experience in making race cars, but, you know, Lamborghini were really the first ones to build and sell a mid-engine supercar to the public, so it seemed like a good choice. And plus, at the time, Lamborghini really needed the business, although BMW didn't really understand to what extent Lamborghini needed the business, because the late 70s, the best way to describe the finances at Lamborghini is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, it wasn't like a Ponzi. It wasn't just a scam, but it was like they took BMW's money and then just they used it to pay random bills here and there, as well as spend a lot of it just trying to develop this military truck that I'll get to in a second. And they owed money all over town, and so no parts suppliers would work with them. And so the car wasn't going to get built. BMW just canceled their contract. Not that it made much difference to Lamborghini, because, I mean, you know, they were going bankrupt anyway. But given that BMW had pulled the plug on the project, Lamborghini just said, you know what, screw you, BMW, and they refused to give BMW back the prototypes and the blueprints. I mean, again, Lamborghini was hemorrhaging money, and they were going to go into receivership. And so BMW figured that ultimately the unfinished cars would probably, at best, be scrapped. And so what happened was BMW corporate hired some men to show up at the Lamborghini factory in the middle of the night and just break in and steal back the prototype M1 and the drawings. Although BMW, it didn't really make that much difference, because with all the delays and problems that the M1 had had during development, I mean, by the time it would have even been ready, you know, the rules for the racing series BMW had wanted to enter it in had changed, meaning it wasn't actually eligible to compete. Which is what, I mean, again, the normal practice for these things is design a road car and then just modify it for racing. BMW did it the other way around, and it just completely bit them in the ass. Like, they built a race car that they intended to turn into a road car where necessary, and in the end, the goalpost moved, they couldn't even take it racing. And so you can blame Lamborghini if you want. They certainly contributed, but the other way that Lamborghini sought to make money was military contracts. So in 1975, Lamborghini's new technical director was a guy named Franco Baraldini, and he learned of a new military vehicle that needed building. And what happened was, in the early 70s, the U.S. government was looking for a contractor to build them a new truck for the military. And in 1970, a company called FMC, which is the Food, Machinery, and Chemical Corporation, showed off two prototypes for the new truck, the XR31, or XR311. Although it never went anywhere. But the two guys who claimed to be, you know, behind it and have designed it were Rodney Ferris and Bard Johnson. And they still thought that the XR311 was a great design. And so they were going to keep trying to secure a government contract. And so they approached Chrysler to build the thing. But Chrysler wanted nothing to do with it. But coincidentally, Chrysler, they also supplied a lot of parts to Lamborghini. And they knew Lamborghini needed money. So some mutual contracts at Lamborghini put Ferris and Johnson in touch with Baraldini, who looked at their plans and agreed, you know, Lamborghini would build their new truck. And so Johnson and Ferris set up a new company called MTI, which is Mobility Technical International, and they commissioned Lamborghini to build a few prototypes. They called them the Cheetah. And the Cheetah looked crazy. It had a waterproofed Chrysler 360 V8, but it was mounted, it was rear engine, it was mounted behind the rear axle, and it wasn't very good. Because it's a massive, heavy engine, and it's mounted so far back, it handled like crap. And they couldn't figure out a way to make the torsion bar suspension not completely snap apart every time it hit a bump, which isn't really what you want for a military vehicle. And so the U.S. government wasn't interested. But, you know, Lamborghini still showed it off at the 77 Geneva Motor Show, and it attracted some attention. Some good attention from the press and the general public who thought it was cool, and some negative attention, like from FMC, who saw it as a blatant ripoff of their old XR311. And so FMC sued Lamborghini, and they just gave up on the project. But so around that time, and not entirely because of that, you know, 78, the whole Lamborghini company went bankrupt, and they had to be bought out by the Italian government, who placed under the control of two brothers, Jean-Claude and Patrick Mimran. And they were two French guys, and they'd made a lot of money investing in sugarcane and flour and stuff like that. And so naturally, they were the Italian government's top choice to run a supercar firm. And in fact, the two brothers purchased the company out of receivership for $3 million in 1981. But, you know, through all of that, all the bankruptcy and receivership and whatever, the company still kept quietly working on their truck project. And so in 81, they came out with their prototype LM001, which was inexplicably still based on that old FMC design, like the one they had just been sued over internet, like over intellectual property theft, like that car that they had just been sued over. They just, yeah, let's just use that one. So great idea. So they came out with a new one, and they realized that the whole rear engine thing wasn't going to work. And so they scrapped it after one prototype. And so they had the idea to simply move the engine up front. And so they came out with a new prototype, the LMA002. And by that point, they were done using old American V8s. They were just going to use a V12 out of a Countach, which is exactly what you want for military applications. So they brought this project back up, and so they actually had some interest from governments. The Kuwait military was all over this thing. They wanted one really bad. They were talking about placing 3,000 orders. They really liked the thing. So Kuwait, as well as the Saudis, conducted some tests to decide if it would work as their military vehicle of choice, and it did. You know, the Lamborghini, it was brilliant. It was great off-road. It was fast. It was durable. Could handle anything they threw at it. But right around that time, Kuwait was going to war again. And as you might expect, when push actually came to shove, nobody wanted to deal with any kind of Italian car on the battlefield. It had a V12 supercar engine. Like, that wouldn't have worked. And you know, the U.S. military had long since lost interest in this thing because they wanted the AM General Humvee. And so, as a military vehicle, the writing was on the wall. But, you know, they had developed the thing. The guys at Lamborghini figured they'd already just dumped so much money into this thing, they might as well just go ahead and put it into production. And so in 86, they released the LM002. And that was the craziest Lamborghini of them all. I mean, we're talking about an off-road, military-focused, four-wheel drive Lamborghini with the V12 out of a Countach. It was just silly. And it wasn't just silly. It was expensive. It cost $120,000 in 86, which is like $350,000 in today's money. At the time, that was more than a Countach. Countach was like $100,000. A Ferrari Testarossa would have been around $90,000. A fully loaded Porsche 911 Turbo is like $48,000. A well-optioned Rolls-Royce Silver Spur wouldn't have cost as much as this Lamborghini off-road thing. You know, this thing is $120,000. And arguably, the LM002's closest competition was a Range Rover, and those started at $30,000. And so the thing was insanely expensive. But it was also extremely capable for what it was. I mean, again, 444 horsepower. It's a Lamborghini Countach engine. So Car and Driver reported a 0-60 time of 7.7 seconds. And that's not that insane by today's standards, but that was about the same as a Porsche 944. Except a 944 weighed like 2,800, 2,900 pounds. This thing weighed 6,800 pounds. Which means this Lamborghini weighed more, it weighed 400 pounds more than a Hummer H2, which is a vehicle that's very famous for being very heavy. But I mean, again, 444 horsepower. It moved. But, I mean, as you might expect, the cost, it's too ridiculous. They didn't sell tons of them. They only sold around 300 of them. But it's just crazy. But, you know, in spite of that, by the end of the 80s, Lamborghini actually seemed to be doing okay. They weren't actually losing money for once. The Countach was still selling because they had kept it refreshed throughout the years. They increased power and displacement. And oh, another side note about the Countach. So when it came out in 74... it used basically the same 3.9-liter V12 as the Miura had. But for 82, they wanted to up the power and raise the displacement. And so they just bored and stroked it out. I'm not claiming to be a mechanic here, but, you know, when you bore out an engine, you're essentially making the cylinder wider, giving it a wider diameter, meaning you know, you remove material from the cylinder walls when you do it, and it makes the cylinder bigger. And then when you stroke an engine, I guess it depends, but generally you stroke an engine, you make the connecting rod longer, and so the piston can travel farther and have more compression. That's the idea. But the problem with doing both of those things is you can only do it up to a certain point. Lamborghini did it to the max in 82. You know, there's only so much metal and so much room within said engine to do those things. And so, you know, they wanted to increase the power and displacement again in 85, but they didn't want to go to the trouble of developing an all-new engine. And so what they did was they just added more material. They just added a spacer between the block and the head. So, like, just the same basic engine, let's just add a hunk of metal to make the cylinder bigger. And boom, you know, a longer stroke, more displacement, more power. That's the Lamborghini way, and it worked great. And you know, it worked great. I mean, it took the engine from a 4.8 to a 5.2 liter. But anyway, so 87, the Mimron brothers sold Lamborghini to Chrysler for $25.2 million. Again, they paid three for it 6 years earlier. So that was a good deal for them. And so Chrysler knows they need to get a new car ready to replace the Countach because it was well over a decade old at that point. And so, you know, they have Lamborghini. Chrysler has Lamborghini. And they have Lamborghini design the engine for the new Dodge Viper that was coming out in the early 90s. And they unveiled the next Lamborghini supercar, the Diablo. And you know, Lamborghini had been working on that car since the mid-80s, but they never actually got around to making it. The prototype had been styled by Marcello Gandini again, same guy who styled the Miura, the Countach. But Chrysler executives thought they knew better, and they might have, but you know, for whatever difference it makes, Gandini's original design was eventually used pretty closely on a different supercar that nobody's ever heard of. It was the Chisetta Marauder V16T. And that was it was a passion project of a music composer named Giorgio Moroder and Claudio Zampoli, who was a very famous exotic car mechanic in Los Angeles, very famous. I don't know if you've heard the story of how Sammy Hagar joined Van Halen, but it was basically like David Lee Roth quit the band, and so Eddie Van Halen was looking for a new singer. And so he's telling his Ferrari mechanic about it, and his mechanic recommended one of his other customers, who was Sammy Hagar, who always serviced his Ferrari Boxer with him. Well, that was Claudio Zampoli. And in fact, in the opening sequence of the MTV video for I Can't Drive 55, Claudio is there. He's the mechanic. So this is a supercar. The guy who, for all intents and purposes, formed Van Hagar, designed and built his own supercar that used the original styling for the Diablo. And it had a V16 engine and four pop-up headlights, and they sold like 11 of them. But it was still cool. And it looks kind of like a Diablo, really. More like a Diablo than the actual Diablo, because Chrysler revised Gandini's design, and they made it look, frankly, more boring. You know, it's fine. It looked crazy compared to every other car still. I mean, it still looked like a Lamborghini, but it kind of smoothed off some of Gandini's lines. And Chrysler also made sure that every version of the Diablo was capable of at least 200 miles an hour, which was the style at the time. And they gave it a 5.7 liter version of that same basic V12 engine from the 60s. And it was very fast. It made a ton of power. The problem was it didn't make Chrysler any money. You know, the first year it was on sale, you know, Chrysler had made a profit on it, but like the sales slowed and Chrysler just didn't want to deal with it anymore. And so in 94, they sold Lamborghini to some Asians. There was a Malaysian company called Mycom Sedco and an Indonesian company called V apostrophe Power Corporation. And they basically split ownership and they did nothing with it really except continue to make the Diablo. Although they, under them, they came out with the SV version and that was cool. And they came out with a bunch of concepts, but ultimately, in 98, you know, Audi bought Lamborghini because that was when Ferdinand Piëch was on that big buying spree. You know, they bought Bentley and Bugatti. And, you know, the thing is, ever since Lamborghini's been under the VW Audi corporate umbrella, they've been doing all right. The Murciélago came out for the 02 model year as a replacement for the Diablo. And it did really well. I mean, by Lamborghini standards, they sold about 4,100 Murciélagos, which was, I think, 40% more than they sold Diablos. And the Diablo itself had been a pretty decent sales success compared to the Countach and Miura. But the big success was the Gallardo, because from 04 to 13, they sold 14,000 Gallardos, which when the Gallardo left production, it accounted for half the Lamborghinis that had ever been sold, 14,000 of them. It did really well. And, you know, I'm sure a big contributor to Lamborghini's success under Audi is that the cars actually work properly, at least compared to the way things were before. I mean, the cars are well-built and well-designed and fairly reliable. compared to when Italians were running everything. You know, and of course, Audi actually runs Lamborghini like a business, which was unheard of for Lamborghini up to that point. And so VW Audi isn't in the business of losing money. And they realized Lamborghini can't just be a halo car to draw people into the brand, because what brand? Volkswagen? That was one of the mistakes that Chrysler had made. I remember seeing photos of Chrysler unveiling some version of the Diablo, and they did it next to one of the Chrysler minivans, which is hilarious. Like they thought that, you know, just because they own Lamborghini, it would drive up sales of the rest of their cars. Like, you know, they thought people would see a Lamborghini and have the sudden urge to buy a Dodge Shadow. Volkswagen's always known that's not a great strategy, not for Lamborghini anyway. Nobody's looking at the Lamborghini Aventador thinking, I want to buy a VW Polo because it's made by the same people. And, you know, Volkswagen already kind of had a crazy corporate halo car in the Bugatti Veyron. Although that was more of like a masterclass in engineering and, you know, it was a dumb idea anyway. They lost $4 million on every single one. So, but I mean, the Veyron, it was supposed to show the technology that they were capable of, and it makes more sense, but that wasn't, you know, compared to Bugatti, Lamborghini is a volume car maker. I mean, they sell a lot of cars compared to Bugatti. You know, VW Audi understood that Lamborghini's only actual loyalty is to their shareholders, and that's why, well, nowadays we got the Urus, which is a big family SUV based on, well, it's that same platform that's the Audi Q7 and Q8 and the Cayenne and the Bentley Bentayga. And so the Urus accounts for 60% of Lamborghini sales. So, great. They've made like 30-something thousand of them, and it's fine. I'm sure, for an SUV, I'm sure it's great. But it's the thing I have is I see them around. Like, it's supposed to be when you see a Lamborghini, you're supposed to freak out because they're so rare and so expensive. But, like, on a holiday weekend here at the lake, you'll see, like, 5 Uruses. And they're hideous, too. You know, the best-looking car on that platform is the Audi Q8. It looks great. But they had to make this one look all Lamborghini-ish, and so it didn't turn out well. It looks like they just took a Lamborghini and just shoved it through a Play-Doh fun factory in the shape of a crossover SUV. I don't really like the Urus. And also, under Audi, Lamborghini figured out how to do those ultra-limited run multi-million-dollar designs that are all the rage these days among the supercar makers. The Rebenton, the Centenario, the Veneno, whatever else. They're cash grabs. Everybody knows they're cash grabs. But, like, if Lamborghini wants to let some rich collector guy give him $4 million for a modified Aventador, more power to him. And that's what they do. Although, you know, they do come out with cool stuff occasionally. The Huracan Sturato, which is like the off-road Huracan supercar, is great. But anyway, Lamborghini's got some new cars out. I haven't paid attention to them since like 2019. But anyway, so that's pretty much all I got. That's the show. I'm going to go ahead and read through the schedule. So tomorrow's Tuesday. Because today, February 17th, is the 4-year anniversary of Rush Limbaugh dying. And so 11:06 to 12:36, we're playing the last show that Rush ever did. And 2 to 4 every weekday, 5 days a week. Really Big Shoe, 4 to 5:30, 5 days a week. International Flavor, 5:30 to 7:30, the Show Me History Show. Dave Maupin, Professor Paisley, Bill Mulder, and the topic is the American Revolution from Saratoga up to the Southern Campaign. Wednesday, February 19th. So Wednesday's big day here. 9 to 10, Damn Schwag with Jimmy Tebow. 11 to 1, Gabby Hayes Show. 6 to 8, Ike Skelton Radio Show with Matt Burns. Well, I guess featuring Matt Burns. Thursday, Fitzwell Factor, 6 to 8 with Richard Fitzwell. Friday, Nadine at 9. And the topic is Lisa Panette, Missouri Legislation That You Need to Watch. And 6 to 8, Eye of the Beholder with Pauly. Great show. I mean, they're all great shows. I mean, but... and then we're back here next week, Monday. And the Shield Maidens of Missouri is at some time between... I don't know. Just sometime before 2 is when Shield Maidens is on with Stacey Shore and Lisa Panette. And then Really Big Shoe, International Flavor, and we're back again next week, I think. So, anyway, that's all I got for tonight. I had fun. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.